Isaac Harris, the son of Michael S. Harris and Golda Morris. I am married to Emily Vernon of New York. The Harris family arrived in Van Buren late spring in the year 1910. I was 5 years old at the time, but the memories of Van Buren at that day are still very clear in my mind. At that time, Van Buren was a boom town. The main streets looked very similar to the present Dodge City of the TV program. There was a wooden sidewalk that covered the main street from the site of the old Hammond Hotel up to St. Bruno's Church. All the buildings on the main street were of wood construction, with the exception of two buildings, the Martin General Store and the Joseph Martin Home. The Martin General Store is still in existence. The big brick Martin Home was on the site of what is now the Colonial Inn. There were four large sawmills in the town, plus several small portable sawmills. The Hammond Lumber Company shingle mill was situated on the St. John River at the foot of what is now Lafayette Street. There was a Hammond Lumber Mill at Chapel Eddy, which is now known as the Allendale area. And there was another Hammond Lumber Mill on Bottom Brook at the end of what is now known as Champlain Street. Then in Kegan, we had the St. John Lumber Company. This was, at the time, the largest sawmill east of the Rocky Mountains. In its prime, it employed over 600 men in the mill, and possibly double that number in the woods during the winter months. In those days, the lumber was cut during the winter months and hauled by sea to the brook and river banks. Then, with the spring thaw, the logs were floated down the St. John River through the mill. The riverfront of Van Buren was covered with a series of log booms, which held the logs in the water till the mill was ready to handle them. All the logs carried a brand which identified the owner, much as the cattle were branded in the Old West. During the winter months, entire families went into the woods, and some did not come out till the spring thaw. Log driving time was a period of great excitement through the town. When the drive reached the environs of Van Buren, the men would come into town and let off the pent-up steam of the entire winter in the woods. Maine was a dry state at the time, but somehow every night there was a drunken brawl. There was more going on in town than a three-ring circus, all in the spirit of fun. During the winter months, the town was isolated from the outside. The only means of transportation in and out of the town was by the Wagonalistic Railroad. That had only come into Van Buren in the year 1909. The arrival of the Daily Train No. 1 was a great event. When there was no school, we kids would go to the railroad station to see the train come in. It was exciting. We had three passenger trains a day coming into town at that time. Number one, that used to arrive at about noon. The June train that arrived at about 4 p.m. and then number seven that arrived at about midnight. Why the afternoon train was called the June train, I do not know. Maybe because there was so much gin consumed. This train would leave Bangor early morning, go to Oakfield, then detour via Squawpan Junction into Van Buren, and then up to Fort Kent. The other two trains start up in Van Buren. In the wintertime, travel by rail was uncertain due to the storm. There is a case on record of a train taking 3 days to make the trip to Van Buren from Bangor. In fact, the Van Buren boy, Wilbur Mayo, was a brakeman on that train. In the year 1910, there was no bridge across the St. John River. There was a ferry at about the site of the present bridge. There was another smaller ferry in Allendale at the foot of what is now known as Ferry Street. the main ferry would handle a couple of teams and possibly a dozen or more people on each trip. It was run on a series of ropes and pulleys and operated by manpower. If I recall correctly, it cost a man 5 cents to make the crossing. What they charged per team, I do not know. I always crossed on foot. The kids used to think it was great to make the trip. Sometimes, when it was not too crowded, the ferryman would take a few kids over and back for no charge. That was the kind of people that we had in Van Buren in those days. Everybody was all set to help his neighbor. In times of sickness or disaster, the whole town pitched in to help out the victims. It was a good life. The town of Van Buren of that day was the home of one of the finest hotels in the state of Maine. There was certainly nothing comparable anywhere in Arista County. That was the original Hammond Hotel, a large frame building, 3 stories high, with a 1-story wing that housed the staff. Traveling men who covered Arista County in those days used to arrange their itinerary so as to spend the weekend in Van Buren at the Hammond. They used to save even fresh strawberries in the wintertime, and that was some accomplishment for that day. The rates were high, $2.75 for supper, lodging, and breakfast. Breakfast was a full-course meal, and supper, of course, was a 7-course banquet. Also, they had a special weekend rate. The owner of the hotel was a local tycoon of that time, Mr. Allen Hammond, and Mr. McDougall was the manager, and once in a while, when he was in the mood, he would take us kids into the kitchen and treat us to strawberry shortcake. We'd come home and tell the folks about the treat. They would wish that they could be kids too. It was just great. I can remember the first automobile that came to Van Buren. Family steamer, and it belonged to Mr. Allen Hammond. The factory sent up a trained mechanic with the car, and he acted as chauffeur for Mr. Hammond. He later settled in Van Buren and opened the first garage in town. He was Mr. Eddie Jackson, and he operated the garage on St. John Avenue for a period of years. 4 kids fascinated with that family steamer. Mr. Jackson would explain how to run the car to us kids. And we all felt that this was just a passing fad. Nothing was going to take the place of the horse. We just had him glance up and down the main street at any time of the day or night. And you could see that Van Buren was not a one-horse town. We were used to it and thought nothing of it. At that time, there were hitching posts in front of the stores, very much like the meters of later days. There's really nothing that is so very new. It just comes back in a different form. Food-wise, the town was very self-sufficient in those days. Outside of salt, sugar, coffee, tea, and a few such items, the town grew or raised just about everything that was needed. I used to get the milk twice a day at the Terrio Farm. That was headquartered right on the main street in back of what is now Chanel's Echo Station. There was a large home and a tremendous barn on the site. I used to take a gallon of pail morning and night, and they would fill the pail right from the separator. Was that no good? Nobody knew a pasteurizer in those days, and the milk tasted different. It was something to really enjoy. Most days, I'd also bring along a quart pail with me and get a quart of cream. With that cream, there is nothing like it now. And our meat and poultry was all raised locally. The eggs, of course, were delivered right from the hen. We had fresh eggs delivered every day that were gathered that morning. I don't think that my mother would use a day-old egg. It would be stale. In those days, we even grew apples in Van Buren. In the fall, we folks would buy barrels and barrels of apples and put them down in the basement. We ate them all winter. Also, my mother used to put up quarter upon quarter of crab apples down. Also, cooked some crab apples that were raised locally. Every family had their own garden. The green vegetables were taken direct from the garden to the house. The surplus crop was canned in glass jars and put aside for the winter. Also, we could take gallon upon gallon of strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries. These were put up in jars for the winter months. That's the thought of all that good food makes my mouth water now. My mother used to have a saying that she did not allow any manufactured foods in the house. In the year 1910, that was almost true. In later years, she still did not allow any manufactured foods in the house, but she did go through quite some number of can openings. She was just living in the past. There was one movie house in town. It was located over what was later the Thomas Michaud grocery store. They had movies two nights a week, Wednesdays and Saturdays. Of course, these were silent movies, but there was a piano accompanist. She played along with the picture. Sometimes her timing was off. When they showed the sinking of the Titanic, as the ship was going down beneath the waters, the pianist played Long Green's Wedding March. Maybe she was right. It did divert our minds from the tragedy that was being depicted on the screen. The entire audience was crying and laughing at the same time. What a show. There is nothing like it on television today. My father and mother used to take us to the movies on Wednesday night, almost every week, unless it was too stormy. We used to walk along the wooden sidewalk in a group, and my father carried a flashlight to light up the way. There was no electricity in town yet, and we had no street lights. We thought the kerosene lantern was about the greatest invention ever. We kids used to do our homework under the light of the kerosene lamp and then off to bed. It was really early to bed and early to rise. We used to be up by 6 every morning, and in the summer months even earlier. We took advantage of all the daylight. Now, looking back through the years, I can almost visualize the main street of Van Buren of the period of 1910. It is strange. I forget incidents that happened to me last week, but I can most vividly remember occurrences and scenes of when I was a child. Right now, I can see the main street of the town almost exactly as it was in that period. I shall try to describe some of the highlights of the town. First, I shall start with the Peter Charles Keegan home, which stood exactly on the town line of Van Buren and Hamlin. This was the first house in the town on the Van Buren side of the line. This home was what we would describe as a mansion today. It was a tremendous 2.5-story white house with a porch all around it, and it stood on the crest of what was then known as Keegan Hill. It commanded a most beautiful view of the St. John Valley looking both north and south. Also, as was usual at that time, there was a large barn and stable, all painted beautifully white to match the main house. Mr. Peter Charles Keegan was one of the outstanding citizens of the town. He was an attorney and president of the Van Buren Trust Company. His legal practice extended statewide, and at one time, the Democratic Party tried to get him to run for governor of the state. Mrs. Peter Charles Keegan was a small, very erect, aristocratic lady. She was the daughter of the Chief Justice of the New Brunswick Supreme Court, Judge Sharpe. I can see her now sitting in her carriage, being driven down the main street. She could have been a model for a painting of the English aristocracy of that period. Also, she was a very fine, sweet lady. And when the kids tipped our caps to her, as the carriage went by, she would acknowledge the salutation with a nod of her head. At the foot of Keegan Hill, on the opposite side of the road, stood what is now one of the oldest houses in town. It was a Dickie Sheriff home, and it faced exactly on the Caribou Road, which came to a dead end and turned left at that point. When the age of the automobile began, we used to wonder why none of the cars coming down the hill into town didn't land right into the middle of the Dickie Sheer house. There is one instance where a car did land in the living room. After all, coming down that hill at a terrific speed of 25 miles per hour, it was difficult to make that sharp turn into the town. This house is now occupied by grandson of Dickie Sheer and is the most beautifully kept home. Next to the Dickie Sheer house came the railroad crossing, and then the Allen Smith sawmill and planing right on the main street. Next, at some distance further down, is one of the highlights of the town, Dr. Hammond's home. This was a large two-story building with an expanse of lawn between the house and the Smith Mill. Dr. Hammond used to hide pennies on this lawn in the summertime, and then we kids would go searching for them. After all, in that day, a penny was worth finding. In the first floor of the Hammond home was a filling drugstore, the first drugstore in town. Dr. Hammond had his offices on the remaining part of the first floor. And sooner or later, about everybody in town landed there. He was a fine, most imposing gentleman, a perfect example of a country doctor of that period. He had a terrific sense of humor. And when I write my book, he is going to fill in a good-sized chapter of just anecdotes. We all respected him and loved him. With him in town, we did not need any Blue Cross or Blue Shield. He rendered that service at bargain rates. His usual fee for an office call was 50 cents, except when it didn't feel like charging. Across the street from Dr. Hammond's home stood the general store of Fred Perry, on the site of the present law offices of Philippine. This was a very large general store where you could buy anything and everything. The store itself faced on the main street, and there were a series of storage buildings, then known as the back store. In fact, when the automobile first came in strong, they sold Buick cars. You could buy a set of harness and a Buick automobile all at the same time. Across Station Street, facing Dr. Hammond's home, stood the imposing Hammond Hotel, the largest building in the town. I have already spoken about the old Hammond Hotel, so I won't bore you with any further detail. Then there was the Watson Building, which housed the George Watson Variety Store and the Watson Brothers Grocery Store. All the groceries were in bulk in those days, and everything was weighed for the customer on scale. Those old-time grocery stores had a most appetizing smell. By the time you left with your purchases, you were all ready to go home and eat. Across the street from the Watson store stood the Armand Smith home, which is still standing. Then, adjoining this, on the side of the present shelf station, was Brown's Restaurant, catering mostly to the railroad. Our friend was a Brown boy, who is now General Brown. He used to hang around the restaurant after school hours, and maybe we would get a piece of pie and a glass of milk. He said he got plenty of food at home, but we kids were always picking up treats. Then the Brown boy would go home with me, and we'd pick up another goodie there. Everybody was trying to feed us. We certainly didn't need any vitamin pills in those days. Next to the Watson store stood the Angle of Blood Dry Goods store. This was a large, beautifully kept store that would be a credit to the town today. In those days, the dry goods store sold supplies such as piece goods, notions, etc. Sheets, towels, and other domestic, women's and girls' wearing apparel. The New Hammond Hotel now stands on the site of the Angle of Blood store. Emma Brunt store stood on the corner of Main Street and what was then known as Beefsteak Alley. They called the street Beefsteak Alley because there were a row of 6 houses on the street, and 5 of them were occupied by 5 of the most important women in town, sidewise. My mother, this is Dr. Larrabee, this is Clifford Tilt, this is Bartlett, and this is Charlie Gray. The sitting eight women in those days, these 5 women together are a sight to see. They are most certainly not the blue jeans type of our day. Across the street from the Emil Brunt store on the north corner was the Joe Perrin's home on the site of the present post office. Then adjoining that on what is now Lafayette Street is the Joe Perrin's livery stable, the largest livery stable in town. Across Main Street from the Joe Perrin's home on the corner was the Rennie Albert paint shop. And next to that, the Addis Kagan Furniture Store and Undertaking Parlor. The latter building was a large, impressive, 2-story building with a platform in front about 4 steps high, if I remember correctly. In those days, all the undertakers seemed to be in the furniture business. They did not have undertaking parlors as we have them now. If somebody died, the undertaker picked up the body at the home, took it down to the undertaking parlor where he did the necessary cosmetics, placed the body in the casket, and then returned the body to the home, where the body was laid out in the parlor. In those days, a parlor was a fancy room of a home. Some parlors were never used except for weddings and funerals. And Van Buren, a local undertaker, Mr. Addis Kagan was a small man. Whether to pick up a corpse, regardless of size, strap it to his back and carry it down the stairs to his wedding. Then he returned the body all laid out in the casket. The Albert paint shop and the Addis Kagan furniture store, years later, provided the town with one of its most spectacular fires. They went up together in a blaze of smoke and fire. They were afraid that night that the whole town would burn down. Everybody was so excited that they started hauling out their most precious belongings and piled them up outside the house, ready to haul them away. They saw the story that night that my mother was running around all during the fire, gathering up her children and tying a pair of my father's pants in her arms. He could never account for that pair of pants. I was away at school at the time, but the neighbors always laughed and said it was a sight to see her running around after all those kids carrying that pair of pants. Adjoining the Kagan Furniture Store was the Terrio home in Bond, as I've already mentioned. On the side of the Joe Perrin home, a little way down, was the Richards boarding house. Here, Mrs. Richards served the best food in the town and also made sure that none of us kids went hungry between meals. She was always a soft touch for a cookie and a glass of milk, at the very least. Then on the side of the present Newberry store, we had Daniel's Driver's store, and then the Fred Smith Driver's store. There must have been plenty of business in the town in those days to support all those stores. Further down the street, on the side of Hilton's Dress Shop, was the law office of Peter Charles Peters. This was an office facing on the street, and lined on 3 sides with a law library that extended from floor to ceiling. We kids used to walk by there, and Mr. Kagan was sitting at his desk, facing the street, we would tip our cap. He would nod and return. Just below that was the Joe Martin Barbershop. This had a setup in the basement where a man could go downstairs and take a hot bath. And then coming out of the woods, we had for the bath as soon as they had seen an open bootlegger. Then after cleaning up, they would get a haircut and shave. These present-day hippies think that they can't grow a crop of hair. They should have seen those old-time woodsmen when they came out of the woods. maybe our present day hippies are trying to look like they just spent their winter in the woods. My father thought that town was located near the Joe Martin Barbershop on the site of the present Sidman Drug Company. Next to that was the Joe Coffey Men's Store and the office of the trial justice. Then we had the First National Bank and the Van Buren Hardware, which was later converted to the Van Buren Town Office. On the corner, on the side of the present Van Buren Hotel, was the U.S. Post Office, the busiest spot in town. In those days, everybody called for their mail, and the post office was a regular meeting room. Across from my father's store, the Allen Hammond Mansion, of which I've already spoken. Then, separated by a large, beautiful lawn, was the Van Buren Trust Company. It was a large wooden building about 6 steps up off the street. Next to that was the Red Boarding House, and then on the corner, the Bouchard House, which at that time housed the telephone exchange in the U.S. Customs Office. The telephone exchange was manned by a local girl, and it was a real convenience. You could pick up the receiver and ask for Mrs. Gray. The operator said, "Mrs. Gray's not in right now. She's visiting at Mrs. Stokes' house. You want me to call her there?" "You can't get service like that now." Upstairs, Mr. Bouchard operated the local photography shop. Even in those days, every wedding couple had to have their picture taken. Across High Street was the law office of John B. Trotsky, with our first selection for a long period of years. Also, if I remember right, the town office was in the same building. Somehow, in those days, they seemed to accomplish the same amount of work with a great deal less space. The whole town was operated out of a small office manned by the town clerk. Across the street from John B. Trotsky's office was the H.A. Gagne Hardware and Building Supply and the Joe Martin Gagne Hardware and Building Supply, both very large stores that sold a full range of hardware, building supplies, and furniture. Beyond these two stores was the F.O. Mitchell Driver Store, another very large store that could have operated in any city anymore that day. On the bank of Bolingbrook was the Van Buren Gristmill. In those days, the farmers raised buckwheat and had it milled at the gristmill. It was a year-round business, and did we kids enjoy the buckwheat pancakes? Aunt Jemima had nothing on us in those days. Went further up with St. Mary's College. In those days, it was not a college, it was a high school. The local boys went to high school there. We had a large boarding school in Roman. Across the street was the Sacred Heart Convent, where the girls attended elementary and high school. At that time, the Sacred Heart School also had a large enrollment of boarding students. Two boys attended elementary school in a schoolhouse, which stood on the side of the present college home. This was a two-story, three-room schoolhouse. Two classrooms on the main floor and one classroom upstairs. We kids walked to school, rain, shine, or snow. It made no difference. No time off the storms in the wintertime. Some of the boys walked quite some distance every day, but they did not think anything of it. Adjoining the Sacred Heart Convent stood the Evelina Peltier home. It was a perfect example of the old French colonial architecture. This home was made from hewn logs that were joined together with hand-wrought hewn pegs. The occupant of this house, Miss Evelina Peltier, was the granddaughter of the Isaac Michaud who had built the house. She was a seamstress of the old school. She made all my mother's clothes and also my sister's. Her hand stitching could not be duplicated today. In addition, Miss Peltier was a French lady of the old school. My sisters just loved her and would not dream of not visiting Miss Evelina whenever they came home to visit in later years. My mother spent many an afternoon with Evelina. Next to Evelina's Healthcare Home to the home of John B's Healthcare, and next to that the home of Leggett Thibodeau. To Mr. Democrat and Mr. Republican of that day, Lord knows how they managed to coexist side by side. In those days, politics was a very serious business. Just beyond that stood the old St. Bruno's Church, a very large, imposing wooden structure that has been replaced by the present St. Bruno's Church. It stands on just about the same exact spot. Somehow it seems to have had the gift for tearing down the old landmarks instead of trying to preserve them. In the year 1910, the language of the town was French. Everywhere you went, the exception of those places catering to traction, the language spoken was naturally French. The kids picked up the language in short order, right at home with the new language. We even got so that we thought of French and had to transpose it back to English. When my brother Francis went to Portland High School in later years, they called him Frenchie Harris because of his French accent. It is a language that has disappeared with the new generation, and we should make every effort to preserve it. And as part of the heritage of the St. John Valley, it should not be lost.
Si vous voyez un qui est fait en l'air, pas de temps en temps. Ça va être fait ça. En fait, deux jours, ça fait un castor, un petit. C'est lui qui est dedans.